The Rad Podcast is brought to you by MOFO, male optimization formula with organs to boost testosterone. Brad's Macadamia Masterpiece, mind-blowing nut butter blend, now offered on Amazon. Chili Technology, temperature-controlled mattress systems for a good night's sleep. InsideTracker.com, offering blood, DNA, and fitness tracking data all in one place. And Organifi, whole food organic superfood supplements and drink blends. And please visit the shopping page at bradkearns.com for my personal selection of favorite products for health, fitness, and peak performance with great discounts for listeners. Here we go with the show.
The addictive part of some of these endurance sports, you know, it feels really good. The psychological factor, I think you want it to be hard. Like, you really need to push on every one of these. There's just because we are saying you're not laying on the floor at the end of these doesn't mean it's easy. This is just one experiment that I'm doing now, but I've got, you know, 25 more years of lots of different experiments to try. So if something's not working today, you know, I'm okay with it because I know this is, you know, the long game that I'm aiming for.
I want to tell you about Inside Tracker, an awesome new ultra-personalized nutrition and lifestyle program that combines data from your comprehensive blood panels, genetic test results, and lifestyle and fitness data from a Fitbit, for example, and organizes everything into one super cool online portal of your personal health. I am just getting going with this, and it's awesome. It has everything in one spot. For every blood result, you can click on a blog post or watch a video to learn more about these values. It's a great education in general health and self-quantification, and it was developed by leading scientists in aging, genetics, and biometric data from MIT, Tufts, and Harvard. The patented Inside Tracker algorithm calculates your so-called inner age, and it shows each biomarker as either optimized, needs to improve, or at risk. And then you can take precise corrective action with a science-backed plan to reach your performance goals. Oh, mercy, people. On my first round of testing, guess what my inner age was? 62! Shocker! Because I just turned 56. I'm sorry. You know what? When I delivered that blood test, I believe I was a little overtired, and several of my biomarkers were deemed to be subpar. So I made some changes as directed. I recovered better, rested, went back, and delivered way better numbers at the next blood test. The Inside Tracker motto is, change is an inside job, and that is for real. You got to keep tabs on this stuff to be at your best. And they have an amazing deal just for BRAD podcast listeners. They are going to give away a grand prize of $1,500 in Inside Tracker value. So to enter, all you have to do is go to insidetracker.com/BRADPOD, BRADPOD. Check it out right now at the link and enter the contest. Listeners, I'm so excited to introduce you to Dr. Craig Marker. Oh my gosh, I think this guy is a true sage, and this is a health, fitness, homework assignment for you to listen to this show very carefully. Yes, we are going to get a bit scientific at times. I'm doing my best to pull out actionable insights and keep things clear thinking for you, but this is very, very important information about how to design a fitness program appropriately. We also talk about a bunch of other fun stuff like accidental hypertrophy. That's his quote for a protocol that he stumbled upon recently that has served to transform his physique, build muscle, lose body fat. A lot of his subjects are succeeding too. So you're going to get some top secret, cutting edge information that's really interesting because it kind of offers an alternative pathway to the hypertrophy protocol that most of the strength training bodybuilding people are familiar with, which are these exhausting long duration workouts, which might not seem that fun or interesting. We also talk about his breakthrough insight, his landmark article that I believe is one of the best things that have come out of the fitness scene in the last couple decades. And it's the concept of HIIT versus HURT.
I talk about it a lot on the show. I think I've done a breather show of that title where I talk about Dr. Marker's work in detail. And we have a link to the article that you can read for yourself. But generally, it's rethinking these exhaustive, long-duration, high-intensity workouts that seem to frame the centerpiece of the fitness industry in favor of what Dr. Marker calls high-intensity repeat training. So in this show, you're going to get suggestions, the protocol to design an explosive high-intensity workout that's going to give you the best fitness benefits research proven of any kind of exercise that you can do. It doesn't take long. You don't have to do it very often. Dr. Marker talks about going out there 3 days a week and doing these pretty challenging workouts where you're putting out a lot of power. You're putting out a lot of explosive effort, but for very short duration and enjoying what Dr. Marker calls luxurious rest intervals. This is going to transform your fitness experience, especially if you are locked into the traditional approach of these exhaustive, high glycolytic workouts. And we'll explain some of these terms as you're listening. But it's a fast-moving show. You definitely have to listen to this at regular speed or 0.8 to listen to these things and hit repeat if you get a little bit lost. But I think it's really valuable information from Dr. Craig Marker, psychology professor down in Atlanta, Georgia, and fitness leader. He's especially fond of kettlebells. So you're going to learn all about some kettlebell protocol. And at the very end, listen carefully as he talks about this pendulum concept, because I think this is another breakthrough. I'm going to take credit because I pulled it out of him during the interview, but right up there with his hit versus hurt concept, this concept of the pendulum swinging back and forth between a growth, performance, building fitness, and then on the other side of the pendulum, anti-aging and fasting and cell repair, which has been so confusing, especially when people are loaded up on one side as the end-all to healthy living. But it's going to help you really reconcile the importance of working your muscles, fueling those muscles with nice, good food and energy and even carbohydrates, as I offered in my own personal example, and then the flip side of engaging in prolonged fasting and all that great autophagy cell repair stuff that we've been told is the key to health. So all in all, a great show from Dr. Craig Marker. Here we go. Dr. Craig Marker, we are so excited to connect with you because my listeners have heard your name like every second or third show, especially talking about hit versus hurt and all the other great stuff. So thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Brad. It's great to talk with you. I am humbled that you put my name in any article. So thank you.
And just before we hit record, you're telling me about your birthday milestone goals, which are so impressive. And it's such a fun thing to shoot for. So let me check in about that basketball dunking pull-up journey. Where do we stand here, man?
I just have these like sort of challenges that I want to hit, and I don't always have to hit them all together, but usually for milestone birthdays, I try to hit these goals. So 25 pull-ups. So like if you go to, I don't know if where a carnival is or a fair, but they often have the Marine station there. And, if you can do 25 pull-ups, you get a t-shirt. So I always try to be ready to do that. And I love being the, older guy that can't enlist anyways and being able to do the 25 pull-ups. So that's one of the goals. And I'm always not far from that. I'm not bragging. It's just something that I've been kind of close to always and can do pull-ups. But the other one is dunking a basketball. And that one I'm a little ways away from right now. It's been a little while since I've played basketball. So starting that back up again and doing my jumping type training. So it'd be great to give me some good tips on your jumping training. Some other ones for some of these certifications that I have, like doing a, 2.5 times deadlift. That's kind of a goal that I try to hit every once in a while. And then a press with a kettlebell. So just one arm press of half body weight. So about
a one arm press from the ground. A Turkish thing?
Well, so you're not starting Turkish. You can clean it to your arm here. You clean it up to your shoulder, and then you just have to press it. So it's a 44 kilogram for me, or 90 pounds or so, or 95 pounds or so.
So which birthday milestone is approaching next year?
I don't tell anybody about my birthdays. This is kind of something I keep secret, but the 50 is kind of the milestone next year. So
dunking a basketball at 50 when you're under 6 foot, you're like in the Allen Iverson height zone. He was listed at 6'1" his whole career, and he was probably 5'11 and a half. So that's a big challenge, man. How are you going to do it?
I think the big thing that I've always gone to is kettlebell swings. And, you know, that's something that I generally train quite a bit, and that eccentric movement. So the downward movement of the kettlebell and reversing that, it's almost, you know, like a jump. I mean, you're really in a kind of a jump position when you do kettlebell swings. So that, and sometimes even doing an overspeed eccentric. So throwing that kettlebell back down, or even hooking a band to it. I don't do banded ones that often, but that overspeed kind of reverses the force and helps you jump. That's always worked pretty well for me. And practicing jumping, you know, it's I'm not standing there and just jumping and doing a dunk. I get a running start towards it. So, you know, practicing that movement, I mean, it's, you know, the high jump is so technical, and you know, dunking a basketball is a bit technical. You know, also stretching my hand, you know, being able to palm a basketball is, you know, it takes a bit of practice. So that's something that, you know, I might lose grip, you know, every third one. So I really want to make sure I have that grip on the basketball.
But yeah, that could be your best jump. And then the ball's gone flying through the gym. I remember when my son and his boys were trying to dunk in high school, and they definitely had the hops, but the ball would squirt out. And we were filming videos, and I was on the 8 foot basket, which I have plenty of height to get up and slam the basketball, but the timing is so particular, and I'm so impressed. I have so much more respect for the dunking basketball players, because you can be up there, but you don't have everything in sync, and you miss the basket. And we see people missing dunks, and the announcers laugh, and it's like, look, people, this is a really beautiful sequencing of everything, the arm, the wrist, like you said, the palming, and of course the hops. But back to that kettlebell swing. So you're saying that the eccentric part, which is the moving the kettlebell back down to the ground, that's particularly helpful for explosive jumping?
Yeah, there's been a few studies on this as well. Like with advanced volleyball players who already have really good jumping ability, they can, you know, doing kettlebell swings and not really focusing on that overspeed eccentric, but their jump went up 2.5 inches, if I remember correctly. But, you know, I think the jump, if we go back to like Verkhoshansky shock training or what became plyometrics, his original, and it's neat to see his old articles because he's hand-drawn these boxes. They would jump off of a box about waist high and then immediately jump as high as possible. And a kettlebell, that's kind of, you know, if you're not landing properly, if you land with your knees going in or any sort of, you know, not good landing, you can injure yourself. But I think the kettlebell swing accomplishes that, because when you go that downward movement, you absorb the force of the kettlebell and you have to reverse it just like you're going to do with a Verkhoshansky shock jump. So I kind of liken it to a little bit safer plyometric type training. And, you know, that reversing movement is good for any sort of speed type of activity. So once a person dials in their swing, they can start doing it faster on the downswing. They can even kind of throw it back. But I would only do that if you've got a really good swing.
Right. These things are somewhat advanced, where you really have to perfect your technique, and especially the plyometrics. You hear it criticized a lot because it is advanced with high injury risk. And so I like that idea of the kettlebell swing being more friendly for people that are just wanting to get into this. I love the strapped up version, and we'll link to your video where I learned both the importance of throwing that thing down and then snapping the hips nicely, and letting the raise portion be mostly, you know, a drive through the lower legs, because I was always doing it wrong and probably putting injury risk to my shoulders by thinking that it was an arm motion. But it's a nice presentation there, which again, will translate nicely to jumping and lower body strength. And then the hormonal stimulation of the androgen receptors in the legs from this comprehensive lower body move. So if we didn't properly introduce you, you're a big time kettlebell enthusiast and expert, and have worked closely with Pavel, and you have the great certifications. And so here's one big thumbs up vote for the kettlebell people.
Yeah. And if I can go back to what you said, it's not an arm movement. And I think what happens quite often is people, gosh, this is going to sound bad, but people often have too light of a kettlebell. And, you know, and we're been told over and over, don't go, and I think this is good advice, don't go too heavy really too quickly. But for the kettlebell, you know, people will use what's stronger, and sometimes they just feel more comfortable with their arms. But if you weigh them down with a little heavier kettlebell, then they know they have to use their legs to really pop it up. And that's, you know, again, I think getting an instructor and watching your technique is really important before you go heavy. But sometimes a heavier kettlebell can kind of cure that wanting the arms to jump into the movement.
Right. Now it's not so fun for my wrist to try to throw this thing around. I got to get my legs into the mix.
Exactly. Yep.
Okay. Well, I would like to kind of recap this wonderful, groundbreaking article and insight that you offered up, the title of which was HIIT versus HURT. And maybe you can just give the basic explanation. And also, I never asked you this, but like how this, you know, how you stumbled upon this or how this came to be. I wonder if you were like me sitting and observing the fitness industry as a whole and thinking that people are by and large exhausting themselves with inappropriately designed workouts, and then maybe going from there, because it seems to me that most of fitness is either chronic endurance exercise or these prolonged high intensity workouts that are so popularly touted with CrossFit or boot camp or spinning, but they seem to go on and on. And I don't know how people do it personally, because when I go into some of these things, I'm fried after 30 minutes because I'm giving it my all like they're asking me to. And then we're at the halfway point of the workout. I'm like, this don't make no sense, people, unless you guys are all sandbagging except me, I'm ready to walk out of the gym. Okay, I'm turning it over to Craig and HIIT versus HURT.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there's kind of two paths where I didn't necessarily stumble upon it. I think there's been a lot of great people working on this type of issue. You know, one was the original Tabata research, and I was fascinated by it, you know, in that you'd get the same effects as you would from running a 5K or, you know, in the outcome of running a 5K. And, you know, I looked at it and I would see these Tabata type training and, you know, it's 20 seconds on, 10 seconds off, for 8 rounds, so 4 minutes total. And that 8th round is sort of optional. Like if you don't have power in that 7th round, you're not doing that 8th round. So it's like that same thing, you need to walk out. So these Tabata workouts, I would see articles, and this is, you know, where I would get frustrated, but like, you know, I have a 30-minute Tabata and it's like, there's no 30-minute Tabata. Like you said, it's just, nobody can do that much power for 30 minutes. Or it would be, you know, something with planks. And plank is not a Tabata type of exercise. It's, you know, you need something that like Tabata had on the bike or a treadmill. And when you're going 20 seconds on a bike all out, you know, you're losing everything you've got. And, you know, that 10 second rest isn't really helping all that much. A 20 second plank is nothing like 20 seconds on the bike. And at least for me, it isn't. But so, you know, that was one area that I was really interested in. And the other was with Pavel. Pavel was working on a book, which eventually came out, The Quick and the Dead. And we were doing all these research protocols for it. And Pavel's Quick and the Dead is a great read if anybody wants to read it. It has a lot of parallels to Primal Endurance. So it's, you know, with Primal Endurance, and I'm probably not saying exactly right, but you're doing things either really slow or really fast, and you're avoiding that sort of in between. And that's what Pavel was looking at. It's really based off of Verkhoshansky, did some conditioning protocols, and it was stay out of that glycolytic range. And, you know, you can go really fast, but once you get glycolytic, you've got to stop, rest, and then move on. So we were doing all of these different protocols, where we're doing as much lactic work and then rest in between to, you know, so we could do more lactic work. So everything was really powerful and with enough rest in between. And so we called these repeat training instead of high intensity interval, where, you know, Tabata, if you kind of measure power over time, people can't, well, maybe some people can, but I certainly can't keep the power up over that 4 minutes. Even 4 minutes is way too much to keep that much power up. So the goal was keep the power throughout all of the intervals, so they'd be repeats. And then, so you'd have to have enough, we called it luxurious rest in between. And the luxurious rest intervals makes it repeats.
So just to slow down a little, I think most listeners are familiar with that term, the glycolytic range. That means an effort that's burning primarily glucose. And so when we look in exercise physiology and what energy systems are used at various exercise durations, that's where we have these in very important cutoffs that you detail scientifically in the article. But I think we can kind of drift quickly through this in the talk here. But when you're talking about really short bursts of explosive power, we're talking about using a different energy system than the typical glucose burning that we use anywhere from 30 seconds up to, 30 seconds to 2 minutes is primarily glucose. And then you start transitioning into a mixture of glucose and fat. And then under 30 seconds is where we're talking about kind of a different experience to the body than the depleting effects of going and hitting the glucose burning effort over and over. So maybe you can add some more there and also clarify if I didn't hit that right.
No, I think you explained it quite well. And yeah, even that 30 seconds, when you're using this system, like it's at, you know, it's optimal probably between 8 and 15 seconds, and you start using all the creatine phosphates in your system, all the ATP, the limited ATP you already have, the creatine phosphate that's making the ATP quickly, and your body starts to say, okay, we're going to need more energy and let's start ramping this up. So even from 15 to 30, you might still be draining that creatine phosphate system, but the, you know, glycolytic is, you know, starting to ramp up. It takes a little while for that system to ramp up. So it's ramping up slowly and really kicks in about 30 seconds or so. So yeah, they're, you know, and with these type of training programs, you're really trying to hit that, your creatine phosphate system, you know, probably 15 second intervals. We can go into even a little bit later, more of the science, but Forenza and some others, Marty Gabala, have looked at different intervals. And I think, you know, 15 to 20 seconds is that sort of sweet spot where you're really hitting the lactic system and draining it as much as possible. And there's some reasons why we want to drain it. And I think that has longevity benefits, but that's getting too far aside. We can get into that stuff later. But
I guess the big takeaway here is that for most fitness enthusiasts, even serious people who are going to CrossFit 5 days a week or going to the running club and they do track workout on Tuesday night and tempo workout on Thursday, by and large, there's a lot of living in this glycolytic workout zone. And maybe you can talk about some of the potential drawbacks of going and doing these draining, depleting workouts several days a week. And at the same time, never really tapping into the explosive output that you get when you limit your intervals to a much shorter duration than maybe most people are used to.
Let's talk about nootropics. These are supplements designed to improve cognitive function, memory, and creativity. And I'm taking three products from a company called NU Optimal. The products are MetaFocus, which promotes flow state and improves processing speed and mental clarity. It contains ingredients like phenylalanine, B12, ginkgo biloba. I'm taking MetaMemory, which is good for memory retention, verbal fluency, reduced oxidative stress, very important for the brain. This product has things like lion's mane, pine bark, and bacopa. And I'm taking MetaDrive for motivation, stress resilience. It's got a little boost of caffeine in there, ashwagandha, rhodiola. They're wonderful products with a lot of scientific detail and easy to understand information on their website. So you get the big picture of what these products are all about, not just stuffing pills down your face, but how to do the stack, as they call it, strategically. You get a 16-page booklet that'll guide you to optimal use when you purchase. And guess what? 60-day money-back guarantee and 30% discount from me. Listen, I'm not a coffee guy. I'm not a drug guy, but I'm always looking for any type of natural edge I can get, especially for cognition. So guess what? Let's avoid that sugary junk food. Let's get enough sleep, take a power nap when you need one, and consider trying some nootropics to see if you get a natural brain boost. So go visit newoptimal.com, N-U-O-P-T-I-M-A-L, and enter the code BRAD30 to get 30% discount when you try it. newoptimal.com for way more details.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest is something you've mentioned already, the glucose, it taps into glucose and it's wanting to use all the body's glucose. And that makes you quite hungry afterwards for glucose. I think,
this show is sponsored by Jamba Juice. We're talking to Dr. Craig Marker. But yeah, that's the big one because most people are out there trying to drop excess body fat. So they're draining the tank. And guess what happens to the brain and the appetite triggers and all those things when you're constantly depleting yourself? You are headed from the gym right over to Jamba Juice for the medium scone and the energizing smoothie, which is more calories than you just burned in an extremely grueling 1 hour long boot camp or spin class.
Yeah. Yep. And it feels good too. I mean,
Juice. Talk about that too. Yeah.
I mean, it's certainly somewhat addicting. I mean, that idea that, when you feel crushed at the end of and I'll call this a workout. I usually call these training sessions because I think we should be doing training sessions. We should be training to get better at our movements. But this is a workout. You've worked everything out. When you're laying on the ground afterwards, it feels awesome. And like you said, the addictive part, I think this was before we hit record, but the addictive part of some of these endurance sports, it feels really good. And I said this in one of my articles, and I didn't mean to be crass, but I said, I don't care about your feelings. I care about the results. And, we don't care how you feel afterwards. We want you to have the best results. And if you're doing those shorter intervals, you're as powerful as possible, you're building those type 2 muscle fibers that you're going to need as you age. That's what we should be doing instead of trying to, build the glycolytic system is inefficient. It's like a inefficient car that's blowing smoke. It's kind of polluting our body. There's a lot of oxidants produced that our aerobic system has to clean up. And if we're in just the glycolytic system all the time, we start to build these oxidants. And I think it has a good signaling effect initially, but after months of trying to do these things that I think we can start breaking down, we can start having injuries and have some of the things that we're not trying to do by exercising.
That's another good point, that out of the gate, if you've been sitting on your ass too much during COVID because my gym was closed and I haven't been working out and now I'm working out again, hey, anything works and you get that adaptation out of the gate for 30, 60, 90 days. Maybe it's 2 years. I have a lot of experience in the endurance scene of doing this type of training, that type of training, and I feel fantastic for 6 months, and then I'm fried for 6 months after that. So then we want to start to consider a more refined approach that's more aligned with improvement, maintaining health, rather than just getting that workout high. And listeners, keep in mind, Dr. Craig here in his day job is in the world of psychology. So I love how you interject some of those ideas into these fitness articles or fitness commentary, because it is a huge driving factor in the decision-making when people are deciding how to work out. And also, I suppose, deciding the programming of what my boot camp session is going to look like. I want people to get a huge burst of endorphins so they come back. But again, looking down the road, this is not how the body is designed to work. And we're looking at breakdown, burnout, illness, and injury if we lock into that path.
Yeah, most definitely. I think, again, there's so many individual differences with this. And you're coming from a place where you have an aerobic system that, many people would die for. And like your aerobic system. So when your glycolytic system is active. It's producing a lot of lactate, which the aerobic system can use for energy, and the aerobic system cleans up. It's just when that lactate starts to build up, we've got too much of it. Our system gets acidic, and that's, you know, where we start to feel that burn. But for people who have a great aerobic system, you know, the 800 meter people, you know, I was never an 800 meter person. I was a long distance person. But the 800 meter people who can just go and like have that glycolytic system, but they're cleaning it up at the same time, that's amazing. So there are some people that are meant for that and can have the aerobic system that cleans up the mess afterwards. But I think for most people, it's probably not a good place to start for sure.
Yeah. And I think, we are looking to the examples of the elite athletes in many cases for how to design training. I think a lot of coaches are coming from whatever the experience they've had, or maybe they were top athletes back in their day. And so we're modeling these genetic freaks by and large, where most people, and I think you even mentioned this in the Hit versus Hurt article, that the recreational enthusiast is going to be vastly more destroyed by doing 10 times 2 minutes full out with 30 seconds rest or some ridiculous notion that's not aligned with luxurious rest intervals and is too excessive. But if it's Van Niekerk training for the Olympics, he's going to be fine because he's trying to sprint around a 400 meter track at full speed. And then the rest of us are going to have all this fallout. And I especially am concerned about that ammonia toxicity and how that affects the brain neurons. So maybe you could pipe in there about the, you know, the various drawbacks besides that we're going to have too much Jamba Juice after these depleting workouts.
Yeah. And again, it's too much of a good thing, maybe, or maybe ammonia is never a good thing. But, you know, when our ATP is being used, so adeno triphosphate, it's got three phosphate molecules. Whenever we break off a phosphate molecule, we create energy. That's what the muscles are using for energy. Then we have adeno diphosphate. We have two phosphate molecules. When we start breaking off that phosphate, that's when we start getting into adeno monophosphate, and we start building up ammonia. And that ammonia is very toxic to the body. So we don't want too much. We want to clean that up. We want to replenish our adeno diphosphates, put another phosphate on it. We want to replenish that system. So the luxurious rest is cleaning up and building back our ATP and getting rid of the ammonia. So but the longer we train in the glycolytic fashion, the more ammonia we build up and the more detrimental effects. There is some adaptive part to this, though, in that when our ATP drains really quickly, we produce AMPK. AMPK triggers our cells to make more mitochondria. There's a few intermediate steps that I'm kind of skipping over. But, you know, we need, that's why when we train, we adapt. And so sometimes we want that, but too much of it, and then we start to build up toxicity. We start to build up oxidants in the system that start destroying, you know, cellular DNA or other things. So we don't want too much of it, but we want enough just to signal the process so that we can adapt and move on.
Right. And it seems to me that for most people out there who are just trying to get in shape, maybe manage excess body fat, have some success, some results there, that toning everything down several notches and saying that, look, if you go to the gym and do, you know, a 10-second series of kettlebell swings a few times, you're good to go and you can leave and go home. And I think back to that appetite stimulating effects, when you're doing these shorter duration, maximum explosive efforts, using the right energy systems and taking long rest periods in between, you're going to walk away from that workout in a better state.
Yeah, I mean, and you discussed a lot about fasting and, you know, those types of protocols or one meal a day. You know, when I do this type of hurt type training, I'm not that hungry afterwards. Like, I can continue my fast. I often do it fasted for other benefits, you know, fat loss, but also longevity benefits. But, you know, I feel like I'm more energized to continue my fast in ways because I'm, you know, just told the body to burn more fat. Mm. And, you know, it's a nice, efficient aerobic system kind of cleaning up. I think it's even more beneficial to, you know, being fat adapted and these other components.
So can you describe an ideally designed HERT session? And we can pick the desired activity. I always talk about sprinting, like running sprints if you're adapted to it. And if you're not, you can run upstairs or do something that's low or no impact. You can do it on a bicycle. But talk about the parameters, like the work period and the rest intervals and the number of reps and so forth.
Yeah, I always feel like I have to qualify some things, and I'm gonna show you a little picture, but nobody else is gonna be able to see it. But so what I've got on the screen, I've got two different exercises: and jump rope, 20 seconds on, 40 seconds off, and then the heavy bag, 20 seconds on, 40 seconds off. So same intervals, but very different exercises. And there's in the jump rope, you see 8 peaks. So I did 8 intervals, or this person did 8 intervals of 20 seconds on, 40 seconds off. And what you see is a sort of lactate threshold line that's going through there. The person goes up and above the lactate threshold, but then comes down during the recovery. So this exercise, the person can fully recover, clean up the lactate system, and then be ready for the next set. And almost every set is very similar with that cleanup process. The other figure is with the heavy bag. And what we start to see is that accumulation of lactate over time. 20 seconds on, after a while, the person is not recovering fully after 40 seconds off. So I think it depends. So my whole reason for showing this, it depends a little bit on the exercise. And if we're, you know, doing something that's using smaller muscles, and I say the heavy bag is using, you know, the upper body, we have less muscle mass on the upper body. We're burning up the system a little bit faster. So I think shorter rest intervals is probably better for something like that. So a heavy bag, I think, is great, but probably 15 seconds on, 45 seconds off. Something like a sprint, probably, you know, we can go through things faster. We can probably do 15 to 20 seconds. I know, like a bike, 15 seconds, I'm exhausted. But a rower, like 20 seconds is my optimal point. So I'm looking at a range between, you know, 13 to 20 seconds on and 37 to 20 or 37 to, or probably 20, I have to add those up, about 40 seconds off. So every minute on the minute type of things is what I do quite a bit of. But again, people are starting in different places. Some people might need 2 to 4 minutes of rest to really be optimal. I've got a base of an aerobic system that can clean up that person I was just showing you had that base of an aerobic system. So for people who are newer, take 2 to 3 minutes. The key is that exercise is done repeated. Like, so how much power you have on the first one, you should have on the third or seventh or eighth one.
Right.
And I'll use, you know, like an accelerometer to measure power. So when I do kettlebell swings, I use an accelerometer to make sure my swings have the same power that they did early on.
Right. If you're doing something timed, like sprinting down the athletic field, boy, that's a really great tracker, because if you're hitting 11 seconds each time, you know you're delivering a consistent quality of effort. And then if you come in at 12 or 13, you're starting to lose it, which indicates that your workout is wrapping up quickly. Or, and I also like to qualify this, if you're hitting that 11 seconds again, but you're trying significantly harder, like if you envision your own personal graph of effort and there's a spike in it on the fifth or sixth interval, that's also a good indicator, I think, that, you know, that's the end of the workout, is you want this high intensity repeat training, where repeat means two things: not only the performance, the accelerometer, but also, I guess, the degree of difficulty.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yep. In the idea of the psychological factor, I think you want it to be hard. Like, you really need to push on every one of these. There's, just because we are saying you're not laying on the floor at the end of these doesn't mean it's easy. That when you're in those 11 seconds, it's, hard 11 seconds. And I like, to me, it's perfect because I can do anything for 15 seconds. I can endure any pain for 15 seconds. And it's just a perfect amount of time psychologically. But when you're trying to, like you said, when you know you got 30 minutes of this, your body just starts to sandbag and you might not want to, but there's no way that people can put in all the power, you know, in a 30 minute type training session.
Right. Or there's just this selectivity where, you know, raise your hand if you're a drop off or an attrition victim of anything in life. And it's probably because you weren't, you know, ideally suited for it. We just met some people on the hiking trail yesterday and the guy had a CrossFit shirt on. I said, oh yeah, yeah, I'm from Sacramento. And oh, I know that CrossFit place. How long have you been going there? And they say, we've been going for 12 years, 4 to 5 days a week. And I'm like, okay, well, guess what? You're probably in that one percentile that somehow this wonderful fit couple is able to sustain that type of exercise schedule for so long. But, you know, there's a lot of people with torn up shoulders or, you know, lack of interest anymore because it's simply too much, especially for their physiology. This is kind of an aside I just thought of, Craig, but there's this great trainer, Dave Dolay, based in Switzerland. He was an elite athlete. He had the Swiss national record in the 100 meters at 10.16. And he talks about how the our different neurotransmitter profiles, our neurotransmitter dominance can affect how we approach workouts and our ability to, for example, repeat maximum intensity. And so you're talking about this range of recovery from 40 seconds off to where other people might need 2 to 4 minutes off. And he describes how, you know, he was an explosive, high power guy. He ran a 1600 meters, but he says, I would go to track meets, Dave's talking, and he would just sleep in the stands until 15 minutes before his race. He'd wake up, he'd jog down the field a few times, he'd get in the blocks and blast a world-class time. And he says his training partner, who had almost the exact same time, would have an hour and 20-minute warm-up with these stretches and then these wind sprints and then some more power drills. And it was all due to the different neurotransmitter makeup. And then he says he's in his gym, you know, working with clients, and he says, okay, we're going to do an assessment today, and I want you to go 1 minute all out as hard as you can, ready, go. And the person's going, going, going. And then he says, stop. And they say, okay, what next? Like they're just standing there, you know, breathing a little hard. And he's like, was that all out? And the person says, yes, that was as hard as I can go. And then you can look on YouTube, we'll find the link. He's showing an all-out effort of 1 minute where he's doing the battle ropes and then he's doing the pulling the single barbell up and down. And then he's collapsed on the ground in a pile of sweat from a 1 minute workout. And so, boy, we have that individual variation that's a super important element of how to design a workout.
Definitely so, yeah. Just as another quick example, like powerlifters, you see, like, it's kind of, I'm not in the powerlifting world, but I think it's amazing watching, but some of them just really need to get psyched out beforehand. You see their trainer slapping them and hitting them and then they go and lift. And then there are others that are just, you know, calm, cool, and, you know, kind of pull it up. And, you know, I would imagine it's something similar to what you're saying is, you know, this sympathetic nervous system needing to kick in like crazy for these super maximal efforts. But
so back to the dunking, Craig. Let's see now. If this is a big goal and you want to do it right, in your particular case, what would that look like? I mean, you say practicing jumping, that's great. You say doing the kettlebells, but over a week's or a month's time, how many times are you going to go out there and, you know, really put in a big effort toward this goal? And then what's that workout going to look like?
What I've been doing is kind of, it's kind of a section of a overarching umbrella of training, but about 3 days a week, I'm doing these high intensity repeat type training, and I'll do my shock jumps or kettlebell swings. About an hour later, I'll actually go to the basketball court and I'll, you know, just practice the movement, the jumping, and those type of things. So it's a bit, you know, there's other things that I do in my training, but that's the more specific part of it. So 3 days a week is, you know, really where I'm focused on it. And it, not three consecutive, it's three broken up with rest days.
And then how many full out jumps are you going to take in a single workout? And are you watching for a decline in performance, or what are your parameters that are allowing you to design the best workout?
Yeah, definitely. On the basketball court, I think we said before the recording, you were talking about high jumps and you just get, you know, you just want to keep trying. So I do kind of keep a clock, you know, that, you know, I'm going to just practice basketball and practice my jumps. So I'll do like 5 minutes, you know, just shooting around, warming up. Then I'll start jumping lightly. And then I've got 10 minutes where, you know, wherever the rebound comes, I might jump and things like that. So I keep that time under control. Kettlebell swings or the Verkhoshansky shock jumps, I've got like, a set that I'm doing that day. And that oscillates, I vary the amount daily, but it's, you know, it's probably about 25 to 40 jumps or, you know, 30 to 80 swings a day, probably a little bit more volume for swings, but. Yep.
Every day?
No, there's just those 3 days that I do
on those 3 days. And then what about the other days of the week?
There I'm doing a little bit more, you know, strength type training. I'm doing just kind of like, yeah, just general strength. I'm doing some, you know, one-legged strength training, kind of within the like 70 to 80% of one rep max range. So that's kind of a range that I try to stay in. There's some, you know, great studies by Soviet researchers, Medvedev, not going maximal effort that often in strength training is pretty important. This is getting onto a whole nother topic, but yeah, a 60 to 80% range of one rep max is where I'm staying for that. I want to go heavy enough. So 3 to 7 reps on different things. So I'll do, some squats, some deadlifts, I'll do some presses, kind of some pull-ups, some weighted pull-ups and those type of things on the weight training days.
You mentioned the one-legged. Can you describe the importance or benefits of that?
For the most part, when we jump in, you know, there's very few sports where we're jumping, we're standing, squatting down and jumping. So, you know, just like your approach in the high jump, you're running, you're jumping off of one leg. Whenever we're walking or running or we need to be explosive, we're kind of coming off of one leg. So having that one-legged power, the balance, I think helps us, you know, build a proprioception and things that we need. So I try to do a lot of one-legged type of exercises.
Yeah, I think I heard you say that or you wrote it, and it made so much sense. You also might have offered that most of the time when we're trying to do something powerful with our upper body, we're doing it with both hands. We're picking up a heavy rock off the ground. We're doing a pull-up up to the bar. I don't know, maybe if you do one-arm pull-ups, that doesn't apply. But for most of us, we're doing two-arm pull-ups, two-arm picking up heavy stuff. So it makes sense to train with the upper body with both arms and then, you know, go more to the one-legged stuff when we're doing lower body. I love it.
Yeah. No, I forgot I wrote something like that. But yeah.
So also on our list to talk about before we got into basically one of my favorite fitness subjects of the last couple decades was this notion of toning things down and going for that maximum output, that high intensity repeat training, is this accidental hypertrophy concept, you call it, and the great results you've had recently. So maybe we can get into the cutting edge here now.
Yeah. So this started a few years ago. We had this, again, when I was working with Pavel on these protocols for Quick and the Dead, we were testing out all kinds of different work intervals, rest intervals. And most everything we did was with kettlebells because he brought kettlebells to the West and made them popular. But we had this one where we had 25 swings, and these are heavy swings. So like a 48 kilogram or 106 pound kettlebell swinging it 25 times, your posterior chain is burning. My forearms burned the grip of that. And it's a fight to the end to do 25 swings. And so this was the protocol. And then we thought we needed 10 minutes of rest to clean up all of this acid that we burned. So we were just testing out all of these different programs. And then, you know, 10 minutes, people get bored. They don't want to sit for 10 minutes. So we said, okay, you can go do some presses in between. So we just had them do some presses. I kind of modified the presses a little bit. I can send you a link to this. There's an article on T-Nation or on YouTube. It's a hypertrophy conditioning program. And we just have them do those 25 swings every 10 minutes and then presses in between. And we had people like saying, you know, my pants, the waist doesn't fit anymore. My shirts, my shoulders have gotten bigger. We think it's a bit of building up this lactic acid, this glycolytic system with a lot of power. This is not a, 30 minute burn. This is, less than a minute where you really feel the burn, and it's like what sprinters do or what boxers do or gymnasts do. They're probably feeling the burn a little bit, but it's intense and then it's shut off. And so, we did this, that was one program we did. I started playing with a lot of these other shortening rest intervals. And there's a German swim researcher. And what they did was, they want the swimmers to get as fast as possible. So they would sprint and then they'd keep shortening the rest intervals. And so I was trying this out. And because I don't like waiting 10 minutes either. But so we were doing those 20 seconds on, 40 seconds off, and kind of shortening the intervals. And when we started measuring that heart rate, when people started getting into that lactic acid zone and starting to build up towards, round 5, 6, 7, 8, and it became a mental struggle to really push through those. But they're still as powerful. So they're still repeats. But the more the mental struggle, the more the lactic acid system built up, they started to build hypertrophy. And so it was kind of this idea that, if we let that glycolytic system signal our body and maybe create this, anabolic environment, or, we're signaling hormones that these type 2 fibers are getting exhausted, we started to build more type 2 fibers. And, if we think about bodybuilders, they're going for the pump and, in the gym, they're doing, 8 to 15 reps every time, and because they want that pump and they want to go to failure. So it was just kind of the same thing, but with powerful type movements. And so, it's basically the high intensity repeats, but with a little bit more burn. And so it's a really mental struggle to finish at the end.
but it's another path to hypertrophy beyond the one that we've been pounded into our heads is the only way to go, which is this, again, an exhausting prolonged workout where you go to failure over and over and over again. It's the notion that all strength bodybuilders are pretty familiar with. And now we're talking about, I guess, kind of a... I'm not going to call it a hack or a shortcut, but an alternative pathway, which sounds really interesting and fun.
Yeah. I mean, if we think of sprinters, I mean, their body composition is, and I know sprinters are also training in the gym, but they're certainly not training necessarily for body composition. But they're going all out, and and they're trying to get the fastest performance each time, but they're having this sort of accidental hypertrophy by triggering the system with their sprints. And boxers are sprinting as well in a different way, and doing short intervals. So I think it's not something like that I just newly discovered. It was just kind of playing around with this a little bit, and seeing all these changes in the people we tested. And then also in myself, I just I'm not trying to change my body composition, but all of a sudden things
just started. Happening, man. You can't help it. People, you just got to go get new clothes.
Yep.
Amazing. Tell me about that analogy that Verkhas Shansky used with the sink filling up with water.
So Verkhas Shansky, again, is one of the brilliant Soviet scientists, not well known for his conditioning work, but did a lot with that. But he talked about, this sink filling up, and when it got to the top, you'd kind of remove the drain, and that's when you would stop this exercise. So that's repeat training in a nutshell is we fill it up, we stop before we, you know, get too much glycolytic or start spilling water on the floor. I would say that this accidental hypertrophy allows a little water to spill on the floor, and then you, you know, pull the plug and, you know, get enough rest. But yeah, you're allowing, you know, we don't want to say the glycolytic system's all bad. It does trigger some things. As long as we use the system in a certain way, we can use its benefits without getting the negatives.
Mm. Yeah, I'd also contend that once in a while, super fantastic. Go knock yourself out. Go run a 5K race all out once every 2 months or whatever, but not 3 days a week with the crappy time. So again, the SYNC people is the idea of the muscular discomfort and the burn accumulating. And I guess the recent discussion we just had with the hard stuff is more like turning the faucet on full blast. So the sink fills up really fast. It spills over. Everything's fast, fast, fast. Then you pull the drain and everything's good. And then in the other example, you're working really hard for this appropriate duration interval, let's say 13 to 20 seconds, which you mentioned. And so when we get up to that 18, 19, 20, you're feeling the burn, you're feeling the burn, and whoo, there goes the plug. You stop running, you recover fully. And just before we close this section of the discussion, we'll talk about that disassembling and deamination that occurs if you decide to sprint for 30 seconds or a minute or whatever the peppy instructor with the microphone in the front is telling you to do.
Yeah, that's when we start this overflow of water in the sink. That's when we start to create a lot of oxidants that are just building up, and they're not just used for signaling. That's when the AMP is becoming, you know, degraded. We're building up ammonia in the system. And, you know, when AMP is degraded, it's hard to rebuild that. We need to, you know, have all the building blocks and different components. So just a quick supplement suggestion, you know, like when people have heart attacks, having ribose and having, you know, one of those building blocks is important, because the heart is basically not getting oxygen. And then, you know, when it gets flooded with oxygen, it needs to rebuild that. So, you know, it's kind of the same thing that's happening in a heart attack. We're, you know, creating this condition, and if we do it too long, it just creates a lot of damage.
Whew. Okay. Besides that, it's really great. So carry on with your extremely grueling, longer duration sessions. Hopefully everyone followed. I know we got into a little bit of science, but I think the important takeaways here are we need to go hard to get the most fitness adaptations. I know you're familiar with Dr. McGuff's book, Body by Science, and the subtitle says, I forget, but it's something like get super fit with 12 minutes working out a week. And then he goes into plenty of research showing that if you do these workouts correctly, just like the one you described with the accidental hypertrophy, where you're going, what was it, 103 pound kettlebell swings? Okay, that sounds pretty challenging. And if it's for you or I, it's 20 pounds or 40 pounds or whatever's, you know, a challenge to the individual, it's going to rock your world. I promise you, people, you're not going to feel deprived of your workout satisfaction. But maybe we should finish up with your interest in anti-aging and the strategies that you've discovered with as related to working out and some of the other stuff too, if we go off the workout chart into something else.
I think we could probably spend a few hours talking about anti-aging and longevity stuff. I know that you're aging backwards, so you probably have a lot to say about this. To kind of give it in a nutshell, I think when we think of our mitochondria, it goes through different processes, and it goes through a fission process where it's splitting in two when we need to make more of it. And small mitochondria, you've got more of them, but they're just not as efficient and they don't work as well. So we also need fusion where they combine and you know, make bigger ones. So AMPK, which is something that we create a lot of when we work out intensely, you know, kind of triggers this fission process. So making more mitochondria. So when I do these HERT type of training sessions, I want AMPK, I want fission, I want to create more mitochondria. I want to break down my body in certain ways and also like create autophagy and, you know, break down, get rid of the bad cells and those type of things. So on a, in a fasted state, I'll do these HERT type training, trying to make my mitochondria more, have more mitochondria and also get rid of some bad stuff. So I'm super simplifying this. I know we don't have much time left, but
we'll have to do a whole anti-aging show, but this will tease everybody here.
Yep. So 3 days a week, I'm doing, you know, what I call fission days with high intensity repeat. And then on fusion days, you know, if we want mTOR, where mTOR is kind of the opposite of AMPK, we want muscle growth, we want, you know, the mitochondria to fuse. I'll, you know, and I can eat a little bit differently. I might not eat one meal a day on fusion days. I'll train and then I'll eat. You know, we want a balance of these two processes. You know, I think fasting is great, but if I fast all the time, I also need to build muscle. So as I age, you know, I want to have as much type 2 muscle fiber as possible. That's, you know, a key indicator of longevity. So I, you know, I we want to have a pendulum. And the way that I think of it is if I can make the pendulum swing a little bit further, so fasting, get the autophagy processes going, create AMPK where I'm building more mitochondria. And then on other days where I'm building muscle and, you know, shutting down that some of those autophagy processes and building, you know, so that's kind of what I'm doing. I'm doing, you know, different days, you know, with a different goal in mind. So that's the quick and the dirty version of it.
Oh my gosh, that's solid gold, Craig. I love it. That's another breakthrough insight, the pendulum, because personally, I've been wrestling with all the information that's blown into my head over the past decade. And we often get confused and led down one path or the other, thinking that it's the end all. And I think there's kind of been a little bit of a backlash with the incredible popularity of keto and then the super fit female 5 times a week CrossFit who already has a 6-pack thinking that she needs to go and do these fasted workouts and fast afterwards to get the wonderful autophagy benefits. But then we also have to put on a checklist the number of stress factors in one's life, especially when we're talking to a psychologist here. But personally, I'm going to volunteer that when I was deep into keto, doing the research for the book and trying to do my crazy ass sprint workouts, and I wasn't listening to Dr. Marker yet, so I wasn't resting enough between intervals, which is another way to blow yourself out, even if you're not going for, you know, over 30 seconds. And then, you know, restricting my carbohydrate intake in the name of the wonderful benefits of ketosis, I believe that it conspired to throw me out of stress rest balance, and I needed to swing that pendulum over to the side of slamming some additional bowls of popcorn, higher carbohydrate intake. You talk about fasted workouts. That's great. And then you talk about a different type of workout where maybe you're coming home and making a beautiful smoothie like my recovery smoothie that I now go out of my way to hit as soon as I'm done with my sprint workout in the name of promoting that. So fission and fusion, that's a little more scientific than Brad Kern's rambling here, but I love that pendulum concept.
Yeah, the tricky part is what I haven't figured out yet is timing of it. You know, so I will do a longer fast every once in a while, but, you know, should I be in a week in fission or and then a week in fusion, or is it a day in each, or, you know, those type of things. So I've gotten down to, I was doing kind of starting with week of fission, you know, where I do every day a 24-hour fast, one meal a day. And then it became like 2 or 3 days. And now I'm kind of down to 1 day fission, 1 day fusion. But I'm still trying to figure out the right intervals that, you know, is optimal for us. That I think is going to take some time. But
that's huge, man. When you figure it out, we'll have you back on the show to tell the secret to the planet. I mean, Dr. Atiyah's deep into this too, and I think has done a lot of effort to figure this stuff out more than anybody, doing his quarterly 5-day fast and measuring everything obsessively, and including his ketone values and his glucose on the nonstop continuous glucose monitor for years and years. And the jury's still out. I'm going to put in a vote for thinking that if you are hitting a lot of those checkpoints, like the food that Craig does eat after his workout is not junk food from the Winn-Dixie, I think we're well down the road of optimal, and maybe there's not a whole lot more there to discover, especially when we're talking about longevity and things like that, that we're anyone who's in this mix and making an effort is doing pretty well. But it's always exciting to kind of look and see what's the best. Maybe our psychological state and our appreciation of the journey and satisfaction with workout patterns is also a big factor on the list. I don't know. What do you think about that?
It certainly could be. I think that's, yeah. You know, the more we can measure, the more variables. And like you mentioned, Peter Attia is awesome at measuring things. And I urge everybody to just measure, you know, get blood test if you can. You know, I do a lot of aging tests, like with the Horvath clock and different things. Just measure to see if what you're doing works. You know, so I think all those things are important, and also helps you see the long game. You know, that this is just one experiment that I'm doing now, but I've got, you know, 25 more years of lots of different experiments to try. So if something's not working today, you know, I'm okay with it, because I know this is, you know, the long game that I'm aiming for.
So you got 25 more years of experiments. That'll hit you around 75. And then what's the following 25? You're going to sit back and watch TV or something?
I guess I got a lot more years. I just randomly threw out 25, but hopefully after, many more.
After 25 more years, then you'll have it dialed. Then another 25 will just be human optimization, dunking at age 80 and so forth.
I'm actually just following you. I'm waiting to see where you set your high jump record. And I'm like, okay, so I've got a few more years to catch you. And then whatever you set at the next age, I'm gonna aim for that. So
yeah, my friend JB is like one or 2 years older than me. He says, I'm going after that 90-year-old high jump record. And then I know you're going to bust it. But actually, Craig, the national record in the high jump for 95 plus is it's 0.97 meters. So those of us not familiar with the metric system, that's less than 3 feet, meaning that if you can jump into bed when you're 95 years old, you will set the national record in the high jump. And I have my sights on that value right there. I don't think that's too much to ask.
I love it. That is awesome.
Thank you so much for spending the time. It was a very heavy show with tremendous insights to pull out. I'm going to give you the highest honor and call this a 1.0x show, meaning you have to listen to it at regular speed instead of most of the shows that I listen to that are 1.75 speed, because I have so many that I want to listen to. But then when it starts to get deep, you got to slow down, people. So I want to replay, especially that pendulum commentary that lasted, what, a minute. Go listen to that again, because that I think is really big for people that are deep into this fitness and health optimization. If we can figure out that pendulum, that's a big deal. Keep up the great work. Do you want to give us some ways to connect with you and plugs here at the end of the show?
I've got no plugs.
He's just all about performance, people.
On YouTube, you can check out strength.university or search hypertrophy conditioning program if you want more information about that.
But, yeah, and we'll put links to your videos and the HIT versus HURT article and so forth. Keep it up. Thanks, Dr. Craig Marker. Thanks for listening, everybody. Da, 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 da,
da, da, da. Hey, folks, how about a non-drinker telling you what kind of alcohol you should drink? That's right. It's pseudo-sommelier Brad Kearns here to recommend dry farm wines. Why? Because if you choose to drink, I want you to be healthy and make a superior choice to the mainstream commercial wines. Listen to my podcast with Dry Farm Wines founder Todd White. The insights were astonishing, especially that most all commercial wines are loaded with dozens of chemicals that the FDA allows in your wine but don't have to be listed on the label. And the sugar, oh my goodness, the sugar levels can be as much or more per liter than Coca-Cola, but difficult to taste due to the acidity in the wine. Dry Farm Wines is a membership club where you're shipped hand-picked wines from old-world family-run vineyards in France, Italy, Greece, and Sicily. These wines come from non-irrigated vineyards hundreds of years old that deliver a tastier, higher antioxidant grape, and they're independent lab certified to be completely free from chemical additives and naturally 100% sugar-free. That's right. The sugar was allowed to ferment out instead of be arrested by chemical intervention in the name of pleasing the average consumer palate that has a sweet tooth. The Dry Farm Wines Club has taken off like crazy because ancestral and keto enthusiasts, people who care about their health, appreciate a sugar-free wine. You'll enjoy the variety, the taste, and the pleasant sensation in the aftermath of burning through the alcohol buzz and going on with your life without a hangover. So if you care about your carb intake and your overall health, Dry Farm Wines has a special promotion for podcast listeners. Get your first bottle for a penny when you enroll at dryfarmwines.com/Brad or click on the Dry Farm Wines at the bradkearns.com shopping page. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the show. I love sharing the experience with you and greatly appreciate your support. Please email podcast@bradventures.com with feedback, suggestions, and questions for the Q&A shows. Subscribe to our email list at bradkearns.com for a weekly blast about the published episodes and a wonderful bi-monthly newsletter edition with informative articles and practical tips for all aspects of healthy living. You can also download several awesome free ebooks when you subscribe to the email list. And if you could go to the trouble to leave a 5 or 5-star review with Apple Podcasts or wherever else you listen to the shows, that would be super incredibly awesome. It helps raise the profile of the BRAD podcast and attract new listeners. And did you know that you can share a show with a friend or loved one by just hitting a few buttons in your player and firing off a text message? My awesome podcast player called Overcast allows you to actually record a soundbite excerpt from the episode you're listening to and fire it off with a quick text message. Thank you so much for spreading the word. And remember, be rad.